Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, it's primary day in New York. We'll tell you what you need to know to vote today. With its 19 electoral votes, Pennsylvania is a top-tier prize that has swung between the parties in the last two presidential elections. Both were closely contested, with another highly contentious rematch between President Biden and former President Trump on the table for this November. An automatic recount cannot be ruled out. We speak to VoteBeat PA about how recounts work in the state, even at the precinct level. Believe it or not, it's been 5 years since New York passed a landmark bill to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but the state has missed several major deadlines, and supporters of the bill are getting frustrated. We'll speak to New York Focus, who looked into it. Plus, Moving Toward Health with Maggie Fitzpatrick and Wayne County Blooms. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. There are primary elections today in Colorado, New York, and Utah. There's a special runoff election in South Carolina between two Republican candidates for a congressional seat. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports that in one of New York's Democratic congressional primaries, incumbent Congressman Jamal Bowman is being challenged by Westchester County's executive.
The Israel-Hamas conflict exposed divisions for Democrats in the race, with Congressman Bowman, a progressive forced to defend his more left-leaning position, questioning Israel's efforts in the war. Bowman's challenger, centrist George Latimer, the Westchester County executive, has said he's the pro-Israel candidate in the race. The primary contest for the district, which includes Bronx and Westchester counties, has drawn plenty of spending national attention and high-profile supporters. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders has campaigned on Bowman's behalf, while former presidential candidate and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has put her support behind Latimer. Claudia Grisales, NPR News.
There's unrest today in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. Thousands of people have gathered outside Kenya's parliament building to oppose a new finance bill that raises taxes. The scene in Nairobi has turned violent as Kenyan police are firing on protesters. Reporter Emmanuel Igunza is there. A note, there are the sounds of gunfire behind him.
Just above, we can hear the sound of our helicopter that has been hovering around parliament buildings, and a section of the buildings does seem to be on fire. And this wave of protesters has been coming in since early morning, and they've managed to overwhelm the police completely and push them back.
Emmanuel Agunza reporting from Nairobi, Kenya. Stocks opened mixed this morning as European regulators accused Microsoft of possible antitrust violations. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 100 points in early trading.
Microsoft may have run afoul of EU regulations by bundling its Teams messaging software with its popular suite of Office products. The European Commission says that may have given Teams an unfair advantage. European regulators also accused Apple of anti-competitive behavior this week for making it harder to bypass the company's App Store. The U.S. ambassador to Mexico traveled to a key avocado-growing region as part of a process to restart inspections and exports of the popular fruit. Inspections were temporarily halted last week after U.S. inspectors were assaulted there. Stock in one of Boeing's big suppliers opened lower after reports Boeing wants to use stock rather than cash to buy the company. Spirit AeroSystems makes fuselages for Boeing jets. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR. The International Criminal Court in The Hague has issued arrest warrants for Russia's former defense minister and the Russian military chief of staff. The ICC accuses them of war crimes and attacks on Ukrainian civilians. The U.S. Surgeon General has declared gun violence in the U.S. is a public health crisis. Dr. Vivek Murthy has issued an advisory. He's calling for a ban on assault-style weapons and universal background checks for gun purchases. The Agriculture Department is launching two new free meal programs this summer. From member station WYPR, Bree Hatch reports It's intended to boost food access for children nationwide, especially those in rural areas.
Eligible families will receive $120 per child to spend on groceries this summer through the new Sunbucks program. And all but two states are operating rural drive-through sites where any family can pick up a week's worth of free breakfast and lunch in one stop. Sakina Shabazz is a senior policy advisor for the Food and Nutrition Service. She said these programs ran as pilots during the COVID-19 pandemic.
We wanted to continue offering that, but in a way that was sustainable for our partners. And also with the cost of food going up and that putting a lot of pressure on families' wallets, we want to be able to relieve some of that pressure.
The Department of Agriculture is investing more than $6 billion in summer meal programs this year. For NPR News, I'm Bree Hatch.
There are ground stops this morning at airports in Detroit and the Chicago area. Severe thunderstorms are moving through the region. Heavy rain and flooding have hit the Midwest for several days. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their travel card, Venture. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at rwjf.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Tuesday today is primary day in New York. The Democratic-led state legislature is up for election in November, and a number of assembly primary races are expected to be close, including the GOP primary for the 100th district in most of Sullivan and parts of Orange counties. Here's what to know today. Polls will be closing at 9 p.m. Voters can find their local polling places on the Board of Elections website. New York is a closed primary state, meaning Democrats and Republicans can vote only in their own party's primaries. Unaffiliated or independent voters cannot participate in the primary. The last day to register to vote ahead of the primaries was June 15th, and early voting ended Sunday. All absentee ballots must be dropped off at a polling place by 9 p.m. this evening or postmarked June 25th, and we will have the results for you tomorrow for results in our region. Now, staying with election news, Pennsylvania is a crucial swing state in the general election coming up. Remember in 2020 when former President Donald Trump's campaign paid $3 million so Wisconsin would recount votes in two counties? The result, Joe Biden's lead grew by 87 votes. Such a recount would not be possible in Pennsylvania. There, a recount is automatically ordered if a statewide race falls within a certain margin. Voters can also initiate recounts in their own precincts. With another highly contentious rematch between President Biden and former President Trump on the table this November, an automatic recount cannot be ruled out. In recent years, supporters of losing candidates have also initiated precinct-level recounts that have little chance of changing a race's outcome, but can be used to disrupt the election process. I spoke to Carter Walker at VoteBeat PA about what you need to know about how recounts work in Pennsylvania.
So there's two ways that recounts can happen in Pennsylvania. The main one is if races are very close. Several years ago, the state passed a law that if a statewide race is within 0.5%, then it automatically goes to a recount unless the prospective losing candidate decides they don't want to go through the recount process. The other one is a little bit more complicated, and that's a citizen-driven initiative, which we can talk about if you'd like.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, citizens can request a recount. What are the requirements for a citizen recount?
Yeah, so there's a provision in the law that allows three citizens to request a recount in their precinct. And a precinct is the place that you actually go and cast your ballot on a machine or with a paper ballot. And if three citizens can request that, if they believe there's some kind of fraud or error in a race, they need to put up $50 as a bond. And then if the judge determines that they've met the requirements, they can initiate a recount in that race. It gets a little bit more complicated, though, when we're talking about statewide races. Judges have ruled that if that provision is going to be used in the context of a statewide race, it needs to be filed in all of the precincts where a race occurred. And so for Pennsylvania, that would mean over 9,000 precincts. So it's a little bit limited as a tool for recounting statewide races, but you do see it get used in local races like township board or school board and things like that.
And a precinct is typically the smallest voting district, usually a few hundred voters.
Right, yeah. In Pennsylvania, they're not supposed to be larger than 1,200 voters. And I mean, you know, in our large cities, these could be as small as a single city block. So yeah, it really is. It was meant as a tool when people think there's really something going on at their local level.
Now, this isn't something new as a result of a wave of, you know, new voting laws in the last few years. This is a 100-year-old election law.
Yeah. We did a story on this back in 2022 because it had become a real issue that year. A lot of folks around the state were using it to try and get recounts started in the gubernatorial race. If you remember that year, we had the current governor, Josh Shapiro, running against Senator Doug Mastriano. And some of Mastriano's supporters after the election tried to use this provision to initiate a recount. And it got a little messy that year because it delayed certification of the election. But eventually, after everything wound its way through the courts, where we ended up was the provision says if a voter suspects fraud or error in the race. So where we ended up after everything got argued through the courts was that the courts decided, okay, the petitions either need to be filed in all precincts where the race is occurring, aka statewide, or you need to have at least some kind of evidence of fraud or error if you want to recount in that specific precinct.
So how does Pennsylvania recount votes?
Yeah, so under the more common way that we've seen recounts, the 5% rule, when last time we saw that used was actually in 2022 as well. And there was a recount in the Senate Republican primary for U.S. Senate. The way that occurs is the Secretary of State will say, hey, okay, looking at the unofficial results, we're within that margin, so I'm going to order all counties to perform a recount. And then the counties have to do that recount either on a different machine, tabulation machine, than the ones that were used for the election, or they have to do it by hand. And, you know, it's up to the county to choose which method.
And there are specific dates, too, that this has to be done by.
Yes. This year, I'm going to work off of this year's timeline. I believe the date recount would need to be ordered by November 14th and completed by November 27th.
And in the case of a precinct-level recount petition, they have to file their position at their local court. And then, as you mentioned earlier, then a judge determines if it meets that legal requirement.
That's right. And that has to happen within a couple of days after the election.
Can a recount change election results in Pennsylvania?
It's very unlikely that they do. I mean, and not just in Pennsylvania. Around the nation, it's very uncommon for recounts to change the outcomes of a race. We looked at some data from Fair Vote, a nonprofit that advocates for ranked choice voting. And they had done a study of some 7,000 races over a period of about two decades, I believe. And they had only found three races where the recount changed the outcome of a race. I checked with the Department of State here in Pennsylvania. None of the statewide recounts we've done under the 5% rule have changed the outcome. I also checked with a local lawyer who has used the precinct level recount petitions for some of the clients he's represented. And he said those haven't really changed the outcome of the race. And I think the reason for that is the kind of machines that we use nowadays to count ballots are very accurate. When you see margins changing in a race due to a recount, it's usually because there are some ballots that these machines can't read. Like if a voter makes a stray mark with their pen, like it looks like they hesitated over circling or filling out the bubble for one candidate, but then filled it out for another candidate, the machine won't read those, and then people will read those. Lawyers and party officials and all agree on what the voter's intent was. Sometimes when you go to a recount, you know, people view those things differently than the way they did the first time, and that's why you can see some votes shift, but it's usually not enough to actually change the outcome of the race.
The most recent recount in Pennsylvania was 2022 in that Republican primary for U.S. Senate. That race featured Mehmet Oz beating David McCormick by 902 votes, which was a margin of 0.07%. So that triggered an automatic recount. McCormick conceded before the recount was complete, but then that count ultimately shifted the margin by only 49 votes in Oz's favor, and then Oz went on to lose to Democrat John Fetterman in the general election. So do you think there could be a recount this year?
Well, you know, of course, that'll depend on what we see in November. But, you know, polling for as much as that is worth is very close between President Joe Biden, former President Donald Trump. And of course, it was very close in 2020, the outcome as well. And it almost went to a recount at that point. As I was researching for this article, I was reminded that in the days after, while some mail votes were still being counted, the margin was very tight and very close to that half a percent. So it's not off the table. It could happen.
And it's probably likely that at the precinct level, there will be some of those requests by citizens.
I think it's pretty likely that we'll see some of those. You know, folks on the far right have taken to that method as a way to dispute what they see as errors in the election. And they have consistently done it in the last several cycles. So it would seem that they probably will this year. And as we had previously reported, that could be a particular problem with the presidential race, because unlike in 2020 and unlike in 2022, when these recount petitions caused delays to the certification, Pennsylvania now has a very firm deadline, as do all states, for when we need to get our slate of electors to Congress to keep the process moving on inaugurating our next president. And so if those recount petitions delay things in the courts past or up to that deadline, it could create a headache here in Pennsylvania.
Let's remind folks about that hard deadline. It's December 11th. How did that deadline come to be?
Right. Well, you know, after the 2020 election, Congress took a look at our Electoral Count Act. And, you know, there was this idea of a safe harbor deadline, which was the date by which states had to get their slates of electors to Congress for everything to move forward and for the electoral votes to be counted on January 6th and the president to be inaugurated on January 20th. But it wasn't really set. It wasn't a set and firm deadline. With the Electoral Count Reform Act 2022, they did make that a firm deadline. And so now if we don't get our electors to Congress by that date, we'd likely be going to court to force the state to get that document over to Congress. And like I said, in 2022, we saw these specific precinct level recount petitions push our certification of that year's election all the way into late December. So hopefully that will not be the case this year. But if it is, it would mean that, you know, the Department of State or possibly the winning candidate needs to go to court to first force the state to certify the vote.
Your reporting is part of your Elections 101 series. What do you have coming up to protect folks against misinformation and helping folks make informed decisions in this very pivotal election coming up, especially in Pennsylvania, a key state?
Yeah, some of the things we're going to be looking at next, you know, in Pennsylvania, a lot of states do this, but in Pennsylvania, one of the things that people brought up as an issue in 2020 was late guidance from the Department of State. And the Department of State issues guidance to counties who actually conduct the election on, hey, this is what we believe the law requires. This is how you should do X, Y, or Z thing. And folks were upset that a lot of that guidance came late in the election cycle. So we're going to take a look at how that guidance gets created, you know, what counties have to do or don't have to do with that guidance. Sometimes it's just recommendations. Sometimes it's actual directives. Hey, you got to do this. And then later in the summer, I'm going to take a look at actual instances of voting fraud. I'm going to pull together some data on how prevalent it has been in Pennsylvania and, you know, what impact it has actually had on races.
Looking forward to that because you hear so much about, quote unquote, widespread voter fraud, which doesn't necessarily rise to the levels that some people claim it does. So we'll look for that. We'll have you back. That's Carter Walker, reporter for Vote Beat in partnership with Spotlight PA. Carter, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we'll actually have more information. We'll actually have more from VoteBeat PA tonight on the local edition. More Pennsylvania election news that popped up. A far right-wing group is targeting errors in Pennsylvania's voter registration records with a lawsuit claiming the state is violating federal law on voting system accuracy. But experts say the argument is a stretch and based on a false premise. Listen for more tonight at 6 on the Local Edition. We'll take a break, and when we come back, Missed deadlines are piling up as New York's climate law turns 5. We'll speak to New York Focus about why the state is blowing past key milestones on the way to its big emissions targets. This is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
You're on the go, and Radio Catskill can go with you. Listen live to Radio Catskill on your phone. Just type wjffradio.org into your browser and listen wherever you are. Stay up to date on local news, culture, and NPR on the go on your phone with Radio Catskill.
People talk about polarization, but did you know most of us are in the hopeful majority, tired of political divisions and looking for a way out? That's why Radio Catskill and StoryCorps invite you to have a conversation with someone different and not so different than you. It's one small step where strangers get to know each other as people. Help bridge the divide, one conversation at a time. Sign up at wjffradio.org.
StoryCorps is one small step, and the radio station helps are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. Believe it or not, it's been 5 years since New York passed a landmark bill to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Heralded at the time as one of the world's most ambitious climate plans, the law aims for net zero emissions by 2050 with various interim targets. But the state has missed several major deadlines, and supporters of the bill are getting frustrated. New York Focus is the independent newsroom doing in-depth reporting on how the state really works. Radio Catskill partners with them to regularly bring you their investigative journalism. Radio Catskill's Jason Dole spoke with Colin Kinnerborough, who reports on climate and environmental politics for New York Focus.
On June 19th, 2019, that New York State passed its landmark climate law, the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, or CLCPA. At the time, you know, I think it was really on the cutting edge of what states were doing to combat climate change. It set these big, ambitious goals. I mean, the basic framework is, you know, net zero by 2050, which is something we've seen in lots of countries and other places around the world, kind of following what's set out in the Paris Climate Agreement passed now way back in 2015. And so there were lots of smaller targets along the way, too. There are targets for renewable energy, so getting the state to 70% renewable energy by 2030, and a completely zero emissions electric grid by 2040. There were steps involving reducing energy use in buildings, so basically making them more energy efficient, all kinds of things about, and crucially about, you know, lifting up disadvantaged communities. So communities that had been left behind, you know, in the fossil fuel era that faced disproportionate pollution, you know, disproportionately black and brown communities. So there's a big push to make sure that they get a large share of the benefits. And I think that part of the law, too, was what made it, you know, so seen as a national model. And indeed, the Biden administration has picked up on some of those parts of the law. So it was really seen as groundbreaking at the time.
So can you start to tell us some of the key reasons as you look into this that you're finding for the state failing to meet several of the law's major deadlines so far?
Yeah, so I think if you just take a step back and think about how the law was structured, what it really did primarily was set targets, right? So it's about saying, okay, we want the state to be at this level of renewable energy by the state, this level of greenhouse gas emissions by the state. But it didn't really set out in detail how the state was going to get there, except for a few specific benchmarks in terms of building offshore wind, building battery storage, things like that, building, you know, community distributed rooftop solar, that sort of thing. But, you know, we're talking about decarbonizing the entire economy, right? The way we get around, the buildings we live in, all of those things. And for that, it didn't really fill in a lot of detail. So the first couple of years, it was a lot of planning, and the state did meet its deadlines for putting together this scoping plan that's supposed to be the roadmap for how we get to net zero by 2050. What it hasn't quite managed to do is following through on the steps to actually achieve the things in the scoping plan, or even some of the things, some of the deadlines that are written into the law. So one of them passed back in January, one of the biggest ones, which was for the state to actually issue the regulations that would force polluters to ratchet down emissions. So this was left very open-ended in the law, how the state was going to do that. What they've landed on as their main strategy is called cap and invest, or it's, you know, really it's a version of cap and trade, a policy that we've seen in other states like California, and in Europe, for example. And that's basically putting a price on emissions. And it's a very complicated thing to do. And the state was on a pretty tight timeline to do it. And it missed that deadline back in January. We're still waiting for the regulations. We don't even have a draft of them yet. So they'll probably be, at this point, it's looking like at least a year late. And then more recently, they were supposed to put out a strategy for reducing air pollution in disadvantaged communities based on some monitoring they've been doing over the last couple of years. We're still waiting on that, too. So those are a few examples of the deadlines we're behind on.
And as you're talking there, what I'm realizing, and I'm going to throw this out there in case the listener's feeling a little bit like I am, surprised about that it has been 5 years. I think it's that a lot of us really in the general public started to take more notice of this around the time that the draft scoping plan came out, which would have been in 2022. And so, like, as you're saying, that's already 3 years into the process. And as you're talking about some of these things that have been delayed and not achieved, one of the things I love about New York Focus is you often have great graphs and graphics. And each of these items, you have a great color-coded chart here with a timeline on one side and the status of a given benchmark, a given deadline. One of the big goals, well before 2050, but barreling down us, that we've talked about a few times is what needs to happen by 2030. Can you talk about where we are with the 2030 goals?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is one of the ones that gets the most attention, is this target to get the state to 70% renewable energy by 2030. And this has really been a sore spot. I mean, you know, New York started with a bit of a leg up in terms of, you know, we have these big hydroelectric dams, mainly on the border with Canada that already supply close to a quarter of the state's electricity. So that gets us a little bit of the way. And there's some, you know, wind power that we've had, you know, for now since like the early 2000s. But scaling that up, you know, to reach this 70% goal has been incredibly slow moving. In a previous story, someone I spoke to talked about, you know, a lost decade under Cuomo. So this goes back well before the climate law. But, you know, even since the climate law passed and the state has been doing all these things to try to speed the process up, by my count, we're still at only about 30% renewables as defined in the TLCPA. So that's basically wind, solar, hydro, you know, potentially geothermal and other things, but they're not really on the radar yet for electricity. So there's really a big gap. And then in terms of what they have in the pipeline, as it were, between now and 2030, the state is now talking about, you know, reaching 59%. That's what they're pretty confident they can get to by 2030 at this point. So that's, you know, quite a bit shy of the 70% mark. It's also shy of what they were talking about just a couple of years ago. So back in 2022, the number they gave was 66%. And, you know, that they were confident they could reach because they already had contracts with all these developers. But then there was the pandemic, inflation, all these supply chain issues, a bunch of projects got canceled. and that number dropped down again to 59%. So there's a lot of catch up to do if the state wants to get to that renewable energy target. And as someone pointed out for this story, you know, that renewable energy target is really foundational to the other big 2030 target, which is reducing emissions by 40% statewide. And again, that one we're really not quite on the path to yet. I mean, there's a bit of a delay in the data on this. The last data is from 2021, but at that point, we'd only reduced emissions by about 9% from 1990 levels. So getting from 9 to 40%, we'd need to speed up pretty quickly over the next 6 years, I guess.
What's been the reaction from environmental advocates and policy experts that, you know, were in favor of this law or hopeful for these goals as they look at this progress? What are you hearing?
Yeah, I heard some pretty strong words from some of the advocates that, you know, have been working on this for a long time. You know, some of them talked about how horribly the implementation has been going. And some of them, you know, they really pin it on Governor Hochul. I mean, obviously, this was happening under Governor Cuomo, too. But Governor Hochul is the one who's really picked up the baton the last few years. And, you know, one organizer from New York Renews, which was the group that really kind of spearheaded the push for this law, talked about a failure of leadership that, you know, the governor she's overseeing the agencies that are in charge of, you know, making sure that we meet these deadlines. She has, you know, disproportionate power in getting laws passed and that sort of thing. And the concern is that she hasn't really been using it enough to really advance these goals. And so, yeah, that's, I mean, the overall mood in the climate movement, I would say right now is pretty pessimistic. Although, of course, people emphasize that, you know, we still can get to the 2030 targets and beyond, but we have to really get our act together.
Okay, in that case, and what is Governor Hochul's reaction, or her and her administration's reaction to that criticism in an election year?
Well, unfortunately, the governor's office didn't get back to us about my questions on the big picture here for this story. But, you know, what we heard back from the agencies, and I think what you'll consistently hear from the administration is that this is still, they still see this as a nation leading climate law, and, you know, that New York is still a model for climate action. They have taken steps, you know, to achieve some of the goals here. I mean, they followed California in basically banning gasoline cars, you know, going to all electric for new car sales after 2035. That's one example. They tightened some restrictions on basically some very potent greenhouse gases recently. And, you know, community solar has been, I think I mentioned that earlier, the state has been doing really well, actually, in building out basically local and community solar, so rooftop solar on people's homes, and then, you know, basically smaller solar arrays in towns and communities around the state. That target they're actually ahead on. They're supposed to build 6 gigawatts by next year, and they're almost there already. So, you know, I think that they would generally say the state has been doing a lot. It's really a question of whether it's enough to meet the deadlines set by the law, and, you know, more broadly, that, you know, scientists say are needed to get to meet the Paris Agreement.
You know, one of the things about climate change itself that I think it's been difficult for people to get their heads around is not just the change that is occurring, but then the accelerated rate of change. It occurs as things change in the environment, they trigger other things. So it's almost like an exponential rate of change. You hit a certain point and it accelerates. The warming accelerates. The climate destabilization accelerates. This is something that we've been seeing in recent years. I point that out just to ask you, is there any possibility that a similar acceleration might happen as New York State tries to battle climate change, as it tries to reach these energy efficiency goals? Is there any chance that the next stages, as they get closer to this goal, things start happening quicker just because more work has been done?
Do you mean acceleration in terms of like us getting closer to meeting the goals, or
yes,
acceleration?
Yes, this is me trying to be hopeful, even though there might not really be any cause for it. It's just me looking for some hope in this.
No, I think there's certainly a chance that things are going to accelerate over the next couple of years. I mean, the state, since the climate law passed, has spent a lot of time sort of setting the groundwork to try to, doing all this nitty gritty behind the scenes work to try to improve basically the processes that allow us to do things like build renewable energy. So there's a lot of very technical work that happens behind the scenes. There was reforms to the state's permitting process that were kicked off in 2020 and I think are starting to bear fruit. There have been reforms to what's called the interconnection process, basically how electricity gets connected, new electric generators get connected to the grid. That's been a big hurdle, and I think the reforms are starting to pay off from the data I've seen. So I think there will, and I mentioned the sort of inflation, headwinds that hit in 2021, 2022, and have really slowed down the renewable build out. Those are starting to ease a little bit, and the state is getting back on track on that front. So I think we definitely will see things speed up in the next, 2-3 years. Again, it just comes back to that question of whether it's going to be fast enough.
And what are the potential consequences if we continue to miss these key deadlines? I mean, in some ways, it almost looks like if things just get shifted down the road 5 years, maybe more of these goals would end up being met. I mean, are there any hard and fast consequences here?
That's a great question. I mean, I spoke to one environmental law scholar, kind of a well-known expert in the field, who said that in principle there could be legal consequences. I mean, a lot of these deadlines are baked into the law. So if the state is repeatedly missing them, that could be grounds for a lawsuit, although no one has sued yet or threatened to, as far as I know, or as far as he knows. But apart from that, I mean, it's true. You could say, these deadlines are maybe a little bit arbitrary. What does it matter if it's 2030 or 2031? I think what the framers of the law would point out is, and I have a few people saying this in the story, is this is really the minimum that we need to meet that, to give us any chance of kind of following the track for that, 1.5 Celsius reduction, 2 degrees or less reduction in warming that the Paris Agreement called for, right? This is for New York to do its part in that, that global sort of undertaking. These are really the minimum deadlines we need to meet. And so that would be the case for why the state really should do everything in its power to get to them. But as far as, extreme weather events or other consequences of climate change, does it make a huge difference whether, New York State meets these deadlines 1 year or the following year? Like, no. I think it's just a question about, setting a tone and setting the precedent for whether these things really can be achieved.
All right, Colin Kinneborough, covering climate and environmental politics for New York Focus. Thank you once again for going over this with us.
Jason, always great speaking with you. Thanks for having me on.
And there's this article from New York Focus on our website, wjffradio.org. And you can find out about more of New York Focus's investigative journalism and reporting at their website, nysfocus.com. We'll take a break, and when we come back, Maggie Fitzpatrick, Moving Toward Health and the Power of Commitment. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org, and from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, there is a new hit show on Broadway called Stereophonic.
It's not a very fashionable play. It doesn't have to do with identity politics.
It is an unusual show and unusually good. We talked to the creators and producers of Stereophonic about what its success might mean for the future of live theater. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Maggie Fitzpatrick is the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat, and her column is Moving Toward Health. She joins us every Tuesday to talk about it. It's out on the newsstands and online at scdemocratonline.com. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, I have a question for you.
Okay.
What have you been doing for the last 833 days?
It's not a lot of days.
It's a lot of days.
When I Googled, I had to Google how many days because I was not going to count, you know? And I was like, wow, that's a lot of days. But
So the article is, we'll talk about it, but okay. Like that number is buried at the end. And when I got to the end, I was like, whoa, that is a lot of days. So tell folks what you've been doing for the last 833 days.
Just to, you know, clarify, I have not done it every single day, but for the majority of days, for the last 833 days, I've been taking a walk outside.
Well, yeah. And that's what this column is about, the power of commitment and committing to a walk. You and your husband back in March of 2022 committed to walking every day. And tell folks about this initial commitment.
Yeah. So back in March of 2022, neither of us were really feeling our best at that time. We were in like a season change. Basketball season had just ended. And, you know, when someone's commitment to something kind of ends, you're like, okay, what do we do now? Right. And we knew that we wanted to do something to help us feel better, mostly physically, but also like mentally as well. And so where this actually stemmed from was, there is a mental toughness program called 75 Hard. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
But so we started to do that. And part of that program is doing a 1 45-minute workout outdoors every day. So you have to do two workouts every day, but one of them has to be outside. And so what we decided to do was we were going to go for a walk together every day outside. And that is where this commitment really came from.
75 days, regardless of weather as well.
Yes. One time it was like the most wild thunderstorm ever. And normally in that type of situation, you know, you're taught as a kid and you're just thinking like, I should not be going outside to walk in a thunderstorm. This is very unsafe. Right. So I had to kind of conquer that fear, but yeah, any weather, we still did it.
Yeah. And so, you know, and you talk in the article about how each of these 75 walks were different from another. You spoke about you talk about the thunderstorm, also, you know, at different times of day as well.
Yeah, some early morning, some at midnight, some at 2 a.m. when we got home and we didn't do it yet. Sometimes we were walking in very nice places and sometimes we walked up and down our driveway 87,000 times for 45 minutes.
So what does this say to folks, or what do you want folks to know about this power of commitment as it relates to health?
Yeah. So this isn't something that I really was able to see until I looked back. Right. So after the first 75 days, that was kind of the first place I was able to look back. And since then, you know, I've been able to look back periodically. But when you commit to something like this, it seems maybe trivial. Right. You're like, oh, I'm going to go for a walk every day. OK, like, what's that really going to do for me? Right. But when we commit to something, even if it seems really trivial, and we do it again and again and again and again over time, that's when we actually see the biggest, you know, changes or impact or results from these healthy behaviors that we can commit to. We can get in this mindset of, I'm going to change everything right now and it's all going to happen in this moment, or I have to do something really big and grandiose, right? But it's really actually these really small commitments, like going for a walk every day, that when you compound all of the benefits of that, you're going to see much greater changes in yourself than you would by doing something perfectly once.
Well, and one of the benefits also is strengthening your relationship. You did this with your husband, and so that strengthened your commitment to each other too.
And that's the main reason why we still do it, is because we love that time now. It's something we didn't know that we didn't have, right? We didn't know beforehand that that would have been really valuable to us. But you don't realize how much time you actually don't connect with people, even when you're in the same room as them or doing the same thing as them or going through routines like cooking dinner or, you know, whatever your normal things are.
How did it deepen your relationship?
We were able to just have conversations about anything and everything. And the other thing was we left our phones. So we never brought our phones with us when we were together. If I was by myself, I'd bring my phone with me because, you know, you just never know. It makes me feel a little safer. But when we were together, we would leave our phones and just have conversations about ideas or dreams or problems in the moment, or, you know, even work sometimes work, right? But it gave us that time to connect and have more thoughtful and thorough conversations than just like little bits in passing.
You also write in the article about when you were feeling tension in your relationship, how you used this time to dive a little deeper into what the root cause of that was.
Yeah. I mean, when you're forced to spend 45 minutes with someone, if something is uncomfortable, it's going to come up, you know, like you can't avoid it. And it's one of those things where, like, when you are facing some sort of issue, it is tempting to avoid issues, right? And thankfully, we committed to doing this no matter what. And none of the issues were, you know, in the grand scheme of things, ever really that big. But being able to work through them in the moment made our relationship that much stronger because we're not avoiding things, right? And that can happen if you're going to spend 45 minutes with someone else, or even if you spend 45 minutes with yourself, you have to, you know, kind of face those internal battles as well.
Well, we talk about this a lot. We talk every week about those internal battles. Is that something that these walks and this commitment taught you?
Definitely. I know that for me, I think this is true for a lot of people. I can process things better when I'm moving my body. So I can process things better in my brain when I'm moving my body. And this is a really great way of helping with that, because you're in this like cyclical rhythmic motion of walking, right? So that kind of allows your brain to be able to work through things that are a little bit challenging, because you're not also doing something challenging with your body, right? So that is one of those like mind body connection little hacks that I also love. That's like, let's just stack that benefit right on top, you know?
One of the places you also walked was like at a local school parking lot, you said, with lights. So don't be afraid of the dark. Don't be afraid of the rain.
Yes, we often go to, there's an elementary school in Otisville over by our house, and the parking lot is lit up. So we'll go just like do laps around the parking lot there, and we call ourselves the Otisville Nightwalkers. It's hilarious, and it's just us. But sometimes people join the Otisville Nightwalkers Club, you know, we have a good time.
So what have you learned 833 days later?
833 days later. I think the biggest thing I've learned is that I really enjoy walking outside, and I feel better when I do it.
And if you don't do it?
I miss it, and I feel a little like sluggish or down. You know, when you don't spend time outside, at least for me, it affects my mental health. And so especially if the weather is challenging and you're outside doing a workout, you're like, I'm on top of the world. I can accomplish anything. Nothing can hurt me, not even the rain, you know. And it changes your mental state for the rest of the day. And I really like that.
Well, I mean, we talk about extreme weather. We just gone through a bout of extreme weather. And we should, you know, make a note to caution folks that, you know, do these at times where it's not extreme. You know, if it's really hot, do it in the early morning or inside if you can.
That's a really good point.
When it's, you know, icy outside in the winter, try to be cautious as well.
Or just put on your ice skates, you know. you know, yeah, when it was really hot the last couple of days, we just waited until it was dark. And that was one of those things where it's like, how can I find a location where it is safe for me to walk in the dark? So we went together into Wurtsboro in town and just, you know, walked up and down Sullivan Street, I think is what it's called, like the main street there. I always want to call it Main Street, but it's not Main Street. And, you know, there's lights and there's people around. And so we did our walk there, but it allows you to strengthen your muscle of resourcefulness and creativity as well.
That's Maggie Fitzpatrick. She is the health and wellness columnist at the Sullivan County Democrat. Her column is Moving Toward Health. She's also a member of the Otisville Nightwalkers.
That's good.
Oh, Nightcrawlers.
Maybe we'll have to change it to that one.
If you walk or crawl, either way, it's good.
Not an official club. Just made up.
The article is out in the newsstands today or at scdemocratonline.com. Maggie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. When we come back, Wayne County Blooms, a garden tour with a special benefit. We'll find out more after a break.
Hi there, this is Brian, host of The Secret Show, Friday nights at 9. I'll be playing a mix of indie, alternative, college, rock, and pop, some new music, and some old classics. That's The Secret Show, Friday nights at 9, only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. many people in Wayne County knew Mark Graziadio, who passed away in 2021. He was a vice president at Honesdale National Bank, a former Wayne County commissioner, president of Habitat for Humanity, and chair of the Wayne County Democratic Committee. The Wayne County Blooms Garden Tour this weekend will benefit the Mark Graziadio Scholarship Fund. Farm and Country's Rosie Starr has more about Wayne County Blooms.
For Radio Catskill, this is Rosie Starr. I'm speaking online with Deborah Persch. She's a Wayne County resident. She has some exciting information about the Wayne County Blooms event that's happening on June 30th. It's a garden tour in Wayne County, but it's not just any garden tour. It's a garden tour to benefit the Mark Graziadio Scholarship Fund. So, Deborah, welcome to our program, but please introduce yourself and tell us a bit about yourself and how you're connected to the Wayne Democrats.
Hello, Rosie. Thank you for having me on. My name's Deborah Persch. My husband David and I have lived here in Wayne County for the past 36 years. Northern Wayne, about 20 minutes north of Honesdale. We've lived here. We've raised our three children here, all of whom went to Honesdale High School. And we have been involved with the Wayne County Democrats and with other organizations, Master Gardeners. And I'm actually involved in the Cooperage as well. And we got to know Mark Graziadio through the Wayne County Democrats, but obviously he was known for so many more things.
Yes, when you go onto the website, waynedems.com, it's beautifully written, the information about Mark. Mark Graziadio, he was the past chairman of the Wayne County Democratic Committee and was deeply committed to the ideals that shaped the United States and devoted his life to service in the local community of Wayne County. And so Wayne County residents want to thank him in gratitude for his efforts by setting up this scholarship and to inspire community activism in Wayne County. So let's talk about this garden tour. There's 8 locations for June 30th. It looks like a beautiful day from 10 to 4. Have you been to any of these garden sites?
Oh, yes. No, I know them all. So it's a mix of some very rural gardens up on sort of hillsides with different sorts of focuses in the planting. There's some smaller town gardens in both Honesdale and Hawley and in White Mills, and it's a whole range, people growing at some of them more vegetable oriented, some of them perennials, shrubs, roses, and we think quite a good wide range, gardens that are not generally open to public, but we thought we wanted to have a great range of gardens to show. And also, Rosie, just to say that actually as Mark and Sue, his wife Sue's garden is one of the ones on the tour as a way to memorialize him and his work, not just for Wayne County Democrats, but Habitat for Humanity. He was president. He was a former commissioner and a former board member of NEPA Alliance. And as I would like just to remind people, all the money from the scholarship, yes, sponsored by the Wayne Dems and Quality Printing, is going directly to the scholarship, which is open to any graduating senior in Wayne County. And Wayne County has 5 high schools. It's a senior from one of those high schools who will be receiving the scholarship.
Yes, it's very impressive that a community got together to organize for the benefit of a high school senior that's graduating in 2024.
The 2024 first recipient of the Mark Graziadio Scholarship has been selected, and the award will be presented to that senior on at graduation by the scholarship committee who selected that person.
Let's talk about ways that folks can get tickets. The garden tour to benefit the Mark Graziadio Scholarship Fund is Sunday, June 30th. From 10 a.m. until 4 p.m. And this is the first year that this has happened. This is the first event. Admission is $30. And if you purchase online with PayPal or Venmo, you'll receive by email a brochure with the map and garden addresses that include Google Maps. Now, let's review where folks can buy tickets in person.
people can go to Gretchen's Grotto, a wonderful pizza restaurant at 652 Park Street in Honesdale, Honesdale National Bank Main Street branch, where Mark used to work, at 724 Main Street in Honesdale, or Quality Printing and Design, a co-sponsor of the scholarship, the tour, on 218 6th Street in Honesdale. And then also there was a possibility of purchasing by mail with a check made payable to the scholarship fund and sent to the Wayne County Democrats office in Honesdale, P.O. Box 424, Honesdale, PA 18431.
And we'll remind folks that more information on the scholarship is available at Wayne Dems, WaneDems.com. Their website, and also I think you are able to purchase tickets through the website also?
Yes, you could go to WayneDems.com and you will see it there as the one of the events for this June, and on the front page, and then you can click on those links and it'll take you to the page giving you more details and links to PayPal and to Venmo. And there are also quite a lot of posters and brochures up and around in different locations in Wayne County, and also, I believe, in Calicoon. And all of the links to the PayPal and Venmo are clickable with a cell phone. So you can do it when you see a poster as well as hearing about it on your show.
I'm actually looking at the Wayne County Blooms flyer that I downloaded. And all the 8 sites are lined up almost in a straight line, and they really cut through the beautiful heart of Wayne County's farmland.
Yeah, yes, it does. We had hoped there was, to have them so we could show the whole range of Wayne County, both the, as you say, the so it's a lovely Sunday afternoon drive or Sunday morning drive through Wayne County from up towards Orson and down through the center of the county, and then to both Honesdale, White Mills, and Hawley. So people can enjoy a day out, we hope, visiting as many of these gardens as they can find the time to do so for a great cause.
For a great cause, and it's the 2024 Mark Graziadio Memorial Scholarship that will benefit a high school senior graduating this year in 2024, a Wayne County, PA resident. Is there anything else you'd like to add about this event?
I think it's wonderful that people realize that the money all goes to the scholarship fund, and we have a recipient for this year. And we encourage people to support, and those people who remember Mark from across Wayne County, to come out and support the scholarship and see as many beautiful gardens as possible.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to put out the word for this good cause. It's a community effort all the way around. There's lots of benefits to the community for this.
Thank you, Rosie. Yes, right. We quite agree, and we look forward to seeing people out and about on that day, on June 30th.
Okay. Well, thank you for taking the time to speak with us, and we look forward to hearing more about the results of the scholarship.
Thank you, Rosie, very much indeed. I very much enjoyed our conversation.
And we can tell you the results of the scholarship right now. The first winner of the Mark Graziadio Scholarship has been announced. It's Sarah Spinelli, a graduating senior at Forest City High School. Sarah is the daughter of Beth and Brian Spinelli, and she will be attending Penn State University in the fall to study architecture. Congratulations to Sarah. And thanks to Rosie for that report. Remember to tune in to Farm and Country this Saturday at 10 on Radio Catskill. That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder to go to the website wjffradio.org, click on the red One Small Step StoryCorps button. That'll give you more information about the One Small Step program that we've partnered with StoryCorps to bring folks of different beliefs together to have a meaningful conversation. How about that? You can be a part of it. Look at the facts and also apply to be matched at wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville, specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting. Because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. online at therestorejayville.com. And from The River Reporter, the community newspaper serving four counties along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania and New York, riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, we've got warmer temperatures today, sunshine, high of 84, tonight low 67. Looking ahead to tomorrow afternoon through tomorrow evening, thunderstorms, some heavy, and some could bring hail and damaging winds. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.